Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Your regular financial contributions make it possible for Beth Emmanuel to make D. Thomas Lancaster's weekly sermons available online. We genuinely appreciate your support and hope that you are blessed by these teachings. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's extended virtual family and support our efforts for the kingdom with a gift by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
Genesis 32, the story that I told the children, a difficult passage of the Torah for several reasons. First of all, it's a difficult passage of the Torah because in the Peshat, which is the literal reading of the passage, the literal reading of the text, it looks like Jacob and God have a wrestling match. And in order to accept this literal reading of the text, here's what we have to accept. We have to accept that God sometimes lurks around in the dark and jumps on an unsuspecting fellow. And in addition, making it even more difficult to understand, it appears that Jacob won. He's able to overpower the angel of the Lord, and it seems like the angel of the Lord is left resorting to supernatural illegal wrestling moves. He touches Jacob's hip and wrenches it, this still isn't adequate though, because God can't get away from Jacob, and he actually has to say uncle and ask for mercy, let me go. And why is God in such a hurry? You know, he says it's almost dawn, like he's afraid of the sunlight or something, like a phantom or, you know, some sort of boogeyman or something from mythology. So it's easy to understand when you look at the difficulties of the story why the sages and the ancient commentators wanted to find a way to smooth out the passage. And several solutions have been offered. It's not actually God. It's the angel of the Lord, of course. But it's not actually the angel of the Lord. It's actually not a good angel at all. It's an evil angel. It's Jacob's evil inclination. It's the angel of Esau, the angel of Edom. It's actually not an angel. It's Esau himself. It's the spirit of Esau. It's actually none of these things. It was just a dream. It was a vision. It was a prophetic dream. Or if you've ever heard the messianic interpretation, it was actually Jesus that Jacob was wrestling with, the angel of the Lord. Is a different character. You know, believers want to always put wherever you see the angel of the Lord in the text, Christians want to stick Jesus in there, you know. But I personally have a hard time with Yeshua making cameo appearances in the Old Testament. But another line of interpretation takes it this way and sees it as you know, here's God's finally giving Jacob his comeuppance for all that fleshly sneaking around that he's been doing, you know, to turn him into spiritual Israel. You know, in this interpretation, God is just sick and tired of Jacob sneaking around, tricking everybody out of their birthrights and stuff like that. So he grabs him and gives him a licking. I can't really answer any of these interpretations because these are, I suppose, deeper levels of the text, midrashic tangents, maybe just dodges and cop-outs at points. But you know, if you ask what is the correct way to read the text, you know, when it's Torah, you know, there's 70 facets to the gem of Torah. That's what the sages say. So 70 ways that you can explain and look at any passage of Torah, and all of them are equally true on some level, or I like to say could be equally wrong on some level. But you know, so I'm not really interested in any of those explanations. None of them really work for me. This morning we talked about one of them, the Esau explanation. But on the other hand, I don't have an explanation for the text. I like that. I enjoy a difficult story. You know, I enjoy a difficult text. That's what makes the Bible interesting to me. That's what makes it compelling. So my explanation of this story for you today is to go actually no deeper than what the Torah plainly says. Okay, so let's look at the story again. It starts in Genesis 32 and verse 22. It says, The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Yavok, the Jabbok. And he took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had. The significance of this moment as Jacob crosses over the Jabbok is that he is returning, of course, to the land of Canaan. Last week's story of Jacob leaving the land of Canaan happened 20 or 22 years ago, but it has some similarities to this story that we're going to read now. So remember, when Jacob was leaving the land of Canaan, what happened? He had a mysterious encounter with God at Bethel. He was all alone. The text says the sun had set. It was dark. He had no possessions with him. For whatever reason, the only thing he possessed was his cloak and his staff, as it says in verse 10 of this same chapter, where he says, I had only my staff when I crossed the Jordan. It's night. Jacob is alone, with only his cloak and his staff. He doesn't even have what for a pillow, and he uses a stone. And he has a vision of God. God passes the covenant blessings on to him. So he blesses him. And he promises Jacob, I will be with you and watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. He promises that one day he will bring him back across to the land of Canaan, Eretz Israel. Now, 22 years later for Jacob, that moment has come. And Jacob sends all his wives and children and servants and possessions ahead of him across the river into the land. God has done as he promised at Bethel. He has prospered him. He has blessed him. He has been with him. He has returned him to the land. All these promises are fulfilled. But Jacob is left alone in the dark on the other side with only his staff. And as we read, it says it in verse 24, when the man, and Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. So all night, Jacob is wrestling this strange assailant. I don't know if you've ever done any wrestling, but it's exhausting. An exhausting endeavor, even wrestling an ordinary human being for more than a few minutes, leaves a person weak and shaking. But this is who Jacob is, Yaakov, the wrestler. He's been wrestling since we first saw him as a baby in Rebekah's womb, wrestling with his brother Esau. He's called Yaakov because he would not give up. He would not give up the wrestling point, the wrestling match, even as he was still holding on to Esau's heel when he came down the birth canal, a situation that midwives and obstetricians have assured me is an absolute impossibility. But impossible or not, Jacob would not let go. And so Jacob wrestles the man until daybreak, that first dim light, where it says in verse 25, when the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket. Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled him. Then he said, let me go, for the day has broken. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So the man's not able to overpower Jacob. Touches the socket of his hip. Now, it's not necessary. This could be a supernatural touch, like I said earlier, but it's not necessary. The Hebrew here is ambiguous enough to mean it could mean he touched the socket of his hip, or it could mean he smote the socket of his hip. I think you could read it either way. But either way, the point is that Jacob's hip is wrenched as he wrestled, and still he won't let go. Why is the man afraid of the daybreak, though? I don't think he's afraid of turning to stone or evaporating or something like that. But could it be that he does not want to be seen? That he does not want to be recognized? It's interesting, the thought, because throughout this later half of the book of Genesis, there is a constant motif of concealed identity. Jacob conceals his identity from Isaac. Leah conceals her identity from Jacob. Tamar conceals her identity from Judah. Joseph conceals his identity from his brothers. So you have this strong theme through this part of Genesis, and here the wrestler wants to conceal his identity from Jacob. And it might be that he wants to protect Jacob from his identity. Because with the dawning of the light, he might be afraid. Jacob will see his face. And what do we know about God? No man sees the face of God and lives. So he says, let me go, for it is daybreak. But in either case, you know, it's kind of an uncomfortable place. God pleading with Jacob, please let me go. And you got to ask, what is this about? Hashem, who made the heavens and the earth, who's not contained within the universe, but the universe is in some sense contained within him. He says, let me go. How do we understand that? And Jacob won't let him go. He will not let go of God. Instead, he says, I won't let you go unless, he's going to lay down terms on God. He says, I won't let you go unless you bless me. And in fact, that makes good sense with the Jacob story, because this is what Jacob has been wrestling for all along. That's what he was wrestling with Esau for, God's blessing. This is what he was wrestling with his brother for, you know, his twin, for the right of firstborn. Why? Because the firstborn would receive the blessing that had been given to Abraham and had been given to Isaac. He wanted to be the first to emerge from the womb in order that he might be firstborn and inherit the Abrahamic legacy. So he wrestled Esau in the womb, and his poor mother Rebekah cried out, why am I thus? And Jacob wouldn't give up even after Esau is born, as we know. And then when he tricks Esau out of the blessing, or the birthright, you know, with the bowl of soup, and it's, I've told you, it's not really a trick. You can read it again. It's a deliberate legal transaction. No deception involved there. Esau fully understood the terms and conditions. As it says in the Torah, Esau spurned his birthright. You know, and then there was some trickery with the deceiving Jacob and all that sort of thing. You know, when Isaac asks, who is it? And Jacob replies, it is Esau, your firstborn. He's, as I told you before, he actually has purchased that identity for a bowl of soup. He actually is the firstborn. So, sort of a gray area, a white lie, I guess. Anyway, this is what Jacob wanted. This is what that was all about. He wanted the blessing that had been given to Abraham, the blessing of the seed of Abraham, the blessing passed on to his father Isaac, the promise of the covenant. And God never rebuked him for the. I don't know if you've ever noticed. God never rebukes him for these methods that he employs. He rewarded him. He met him at Bethel, and he rewarded him, and he said, "I am the God of your fathers. I'm going to give you all this. I'm going to give all these promises to you." And he said, "I will be with you, watch over you. Wherever you go, I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I promised you." But now, as we come to this text, God has done all that. He's given Jacob descendants who will multiply and spread and inherit the land. And these descendants have already crossed into the land ahead of him. God has been with Jacob in Paddan Aram. He watched over him. He blessed him. He brought him back. And he's reached that point where he said, I will not leave you until I have done what I promised you. But now he has done what he has promised. So the until point has come. I will not leave you until. God says, let go of me. Jacob says, I won't let go of you until you bless me. That's what he's been wrestling for his entire life. And so the man asks and says, what's your name? And he says, Yaakov. I am the wrestler, Yaakov. And the man said, your name will no longer be Yaakov, but Yisrael, because you've struggled with God and with men and have overcome. So what does Yisrael mean? It means he struggles with God. He wrestles with God. He struggled with God and with men for the blessing, with Esau for the blessing, with Isaac for the blessing, with Laban for the blessing, and he has overcome. And he has overcome God. He has won with God. And how do you win with God? How do you overcome God? How do you fight God and overcome God? Remember what the Master says about the saints in the book of Revelation. He says, regarding the saints in the book of Revelation, he says, blessed are those who overcome. How do you overcome? With God, the way you overcome is you just don't let go. Jacob said in verse 29, he said, please tell me your name. But he says, why is it that you ask my name? It's a rhetorical question. You know, why do you ask my name? You know my name. And there, he blessed him. I mean, that's all Jacob ever wanted. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, which means the face of God, saying, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. My life has been spared. Remember when the sun set on Jacob at Bethel, at Luz, as he was leaving the land of Canaan, the land of promise, and he had his vision of the ladder and the angels, he named the place Beit El, house of God. Now, as the sun rises on Jacob, and he's returning to the land of Canaan, he names the place Peniel, face of God. So did he really see God's face? You know, a dim silhouette as the sun's lighting up the horizon with her rosy red fingers, as Homer would say. I don't think that's the point so much. He really had an encounter with God. And as he enters the land of promise, the sun is rising on him, and we're supposed to see that connection. The sun set as he left the land. Now the sun is rising as he enters the land, and he's limping. And the limp proves it wasn't a dream. It wasn't a vision. This really happened to me. And he's limping on his leg, and he has the limp to prove it. So this is the story. I mean, that's it. Okay, there it was. Jacob the trickster, the deceiver. No. Jacob the wrestler. Jacob the wrestler who recognized that the blessing of God is worth fighting for, worth sticking to it for, worth struggling for. I think that's all the story is trying to tell us. Something that Esau was willing to trade a bowl of soup for, Jacob was willing to wrestle his entire life for. So what do we learn from this strange story? What do we learn from Jacob? I think we should learn the value of the eternal. That's what truth is, the value of emet, the value of truth. We should learn to hold on to God and to refuse to let Hashem go. Because I think we're often pretty quick to let go of him. I mean, when you can't see his face, when we can't see his face, it's easy to let go of him. When he won't tell us his name, we let go of him. When he won't answer our prayer, we let go of him. When he smites us, when he strikes us, we let go of him. Jacob would not let go. And God didn't want him to let him go. God does not want us to let go either. He wants a people that will hold on to him, who will cling to him, who will grasp his heel, so to speak, and hold on tight. I don't understand Hashem, you know. If I understood him, I would be him, right? I don't understand why he conceals himself when he could reveal himself. I don't understand why we have to grope in the darkness to apprehend him, or why he leaps on us in metaphorical darkness of life and existence, but he does. One could go through life without suspecting his existence if it wasn't for the fact that he occasionally jumps on us in the darkness. Probably our darkness is self-imposed. Probably we are like the man in George MacDonald's novel, Phantastis, who sat imprisoned in a tower for 100 years or more until someone pointed out to him that the door was open and always had been, and all he had to do was get up and walk through it. That may be the case. There's two kinds of people in the world. There's the people who say there's two kinds of people in the world and the people who don't. But another two kinds of people in the world, there's two kinds of people in this darkness. There are those who will hold on and those who will not. Those who will hold on, those who will hold on, prove themselves to be sons of our father, Jacob. And those who will not hold on, they break our hearts. The situation is like this. In modernity, man says, I can't see him, and I can't hold on to what I cannot see. I don't know his name. I can't hold on to someone I don't know. Modern man says, I'm going to let go because there's nothing in the dark to hold on to. Or there's another response, like the unthinkable horror and tragedy of those who lost their faith in a great persecution or even a personal tribulation where he smites you and the pain is too great to hold on and we let go. I always think of the survivors of the Holocaust. You know, how many Jewish homes, how many Jewish families were stripped of their faith because of the tragedy that they endured in the Holocaust. Their parents, their grandparents could not hold on to God because they couldn't believe in a God that would have allowed such a thing to happen, to see their own children or their parents brutalized before their eyes. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe warned that we should never stand in judgment over one who has passed through that kind of fire of tribulation. We have no right to criticize someone who turns his back on God under such circumstances, because but for the grace of God, there we go. Also, right, so Richard Wurmbrand tells the story of a priest who was imprisoned with him when the communists were trying to stamp out Christianity. And the jailers forced the priest to serve the other prisoners a sacrament of excrement. And the Christians asked him, how could you have blasphemed Christ like this? And the priest replied, don't judge me. I've suffered more than Christ himself. Physically, anyway, it was true. He had, and it broke him. And it might break any of us suffering. And for the moment, at least, that priest let go. So we read in Voice of the Martyrs about believers who suffer for their faith all over the world, and we read about how they are strengthened by their suffering, but there are equally as many, if not more, that are broken by it. That's persecution. But we all suffer in many ways. It's just the human lot in life to suffer. So what will our response to suffering be? Will we hold on when it's our turn to suffer? Everybody gets a turn. Or not? We should never have to be so tested. None of our children either. Yet, we have to be prepared to be like Jacob and refuse to let go. See, more likely, we're going to find ourselves, as all human beings do, facing situations of inconsolable grief and loss, sickness and disability, bereavement and heartbreak, betrayal, personal betrayal. And all that is within us then will rage at the sky. We're going to pray like this. We're going to pray, God, how could you do such a thing? How could you let this happen to me? Why? And there's a why. And you know what? That's probably the right thing to do. That's probably the right prayer to pray. Because that's not letting go. To let go is to give up on God. And there are others who simply, you know, let go because they don't have the will to wrestle. It takes effort. It takes strength to wrestle with an unseen God. It's easier to just go with the flow, to just accept and believe what is seen and leave these shadowy questions about God and his existence and his demands on our lives to the shadowy realm of agnosticism, or if with chutzpah, atheism. And there are still others who have not encountered God because they are waiting for us to show them that door, to introduce them to the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the God of our Master Yeshua. They've not had the opportunity even to enter the wrestling ring yet. So the Torah tells us the man saw that he could not overcome Jacob. In the revelation to the Apostle Yochanan, the revelation of Yeshua to the Apostle Yochanan, Jesus speaks of those who overcome, right? The overcomers. You familiar with this theme? I pulled out all these passages, several quotations from the lips of the Master to the pen of Yochanan to our ears today. All these passages from Revelation, I'll just rattle them off for you. Okay, listen to this. Revelation 2:11, he who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death. 2:17, to him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna. I will also give him a white stone with a new name written on it, known only to him who receives it. 2:25, only hold on to what you have until I come. To him who overcomes and does my will to the end, I will give authority over the nations. 3:5, he who overcomes will be will like them be dressed in white. I will never blot his name from the book of life, but will acknowledge his name before my Father. 3:12, to him who overcomes, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will he leave it. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which is coming down from heaven. 3:12, to him who overcomes, I will also write on him my new name. 3:21, to him who overcomes, I will give the right to sit with me on my throne, just as I overcame and sat down with my Father. 21:7, to him who overcomes, he will inherit all this, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. How do you overcome? That's the depressing part of it, isn't it? Because if each of us are honest, if we're really honest, we know that if God really fully tested us, we would fail. Because we're such frail creatures. You know, how could we hope to overcome? But learn a lesson from Jacob. To overcome does not mean to conquer. It doesn't mean we have to pin God to the ground. All that Jacob did was to hold on, to not let go. Don't let go. That's the trick. You don't actually need to overpower. You don't actually need to overcome as long as we hold on to the overcomer, he who has overcome the world. So, let's learn about the faith of Jacob. Yaakov Avinu, Jacob our father. What do we learn from Jacob? Hold on. So, I can't see God. You know, you get those places in your life and you're like, I just don't see. Where is God? I can't see. That's when you hold on. You get to those dark places, you know, and it's hard to believe in what you can't see, and it's dark and you can't see. That's when you hold on. And when you're afraid and you're like, what's going to happen? I don't know what's going to happen. That's when you hold on. You know, that's when you don't let go. That's when you struggle with God. You hold on. You don't. And maybe that's actually a great analogy for what faith really is. Being sure of what we hope for. Jacob was sure. He knew what he wanted. Bless me, he said. So are you sure of what you're hoping for? Jacob was sure. Faith is being sure of what you're hoping for and certain of what you do not see. Certain of what you do not see. Jacob was, even in the dark, he held on all night long to what he could not see. That's faith. The triumph of faith. And it's his legacy, our spiritual inheritance, and the inheritance of the sons of Israel.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.